or what are, quote, moral issues. And this is the types of things I hope to discuss today should be somewhat controversial. Feel free to challenge, discuss, ask for clarification, both during the talk, and again, I do hope to leave half the time for just general discussion about this or anything related to it that you'd like. From my background, for those who were not at the first one, I'm a state senator from Minnesota, so the national issues we talk about are not issues that I deal with on a day-to-day basis, but they're things of concern. I'm newly elected, but I was a researcher, so I have worked in the political field for some time. I'm a member of the Democratic Farmer Labor National, that would be the Democratic Party, and like all of you, I'm a Christian and concerned about these things. Before we look at what the, quote, moral issues are, I think we need to discuss statements we've all probably heard from some people, namely that you, quote, can't legislate morality, or from others that you shouldn't legislate morality. And if either of these things are true, we ought not have this discussion today, but I don't ascribe to either of those two positions. As I intend to discuss, I think most issues are moral issues, namely issues of right or wrong, justice or injustice, and therefore they should fall into the categories of areas we as Christians ought to care about, moral issues. Politics has been described in various ways. It basically is our means as a society of settling disputed claims or any kind of disputes between people. And most disputes have ways of settlement that you would call fair or versus unfair, right versus wrong. And as such, they become moral issues. And I'd argue that many, if not most, political issues do involve right versus wrong choices. We may disagree on what is right and what is wrong, but we all agree that this is right and this is wrong. Well, perhaps fair versus unfair is a better way of putting that. And so I'd say it's inevitable that political issues are moral issues. So back again to the brief point, we can't legislate morality, or we shouldn't. Well, we do all the time. I don't think there's any way about it, any way around it. We have to. I think the concern such people who use such quotes are concerned about is that people will force a narrow religious belief or religious practices on others. And I would argue that it's not necessarily, well, it's not moral to force one's personal religious beliefs or religious practices on others, and even widely held religious beliefs or practices, it's not necessarily moral to force them on a minority, which gives us reason to use caution, because if a majority believes a certain practices a certain religion or has certain beliefs, since a majority controls in a democracy, they have to use their own caution. There is no stopping a majority if they were all out set on imposing their will on a minority. Because they have the control in our society, therefore it comes with it the responsibility that they don't force some personal or group religious beliefs on others. And if, as I said, it is acceptable or even necessary that we discuss that political issues involve morality, then we should get to talking about which issues are the, quote, moral issues. I have seen, and I'm sure all of you have, certain candidates, politicians who advertise themselves to be the Christian candidates. In Minnesota a couple years ago, I was speaking at a church on hunger. It was right after an election, and the guy heard that I had worked for our house as a researcher, and, oh, did you know so-and-so? Yes, and he had just lost the race, and he said, well, you wouldn't believe what his opponent was like, and the guy who won. The guy who lost was a Catholic, a large family, strong religious beliefs. I don't know if I certainly didn't see eye to eye with him on every issue, but one thing I don't challenge is the fact that he had strongly held religious beliefs, was a committed Christian. And his opponent came up to this church. It was a Lutheran church, and the opponent wasn't Lutheran either, but the opponent was the, quote, Christian candidate. And the guy just put a lawn sign up in the church property. It was good, two county roads, two highways, intersection, so he put up his signs there. And the pastor wondered how that sign got there and couldn't read the name at the bottom on the disclaimer, and called the guy up and said, somebody put one of your signs in our church property. We'd like you to take it down. And the guy's response is, what do you mean, take it down? I'm the Christian candidate. And he says, well, we didn't give you permission to put it there, and we don't want it there, and we'd appreciate if you'd take it down. He says, well, the churches haven't done enough for my campaign. And he says, so I'm not going to take it down. And the guy said, you take it down or we take it down. And they settled it that way. But such a candidate... I'm not sure. I believe the candidate finally came and decided he was going to reclaim his sign. But a candidate such as him, I read some interviews with him several months later when he was in the legislature, and the issues that he saw his faith is relating to were a handful of issues: gambling, abortion, prayer in the schools, the, quote, living will issues, whether you can terminate a life of someone at their will, at their request, when they're in pain in a terminal illness. The sex laws, such as sodomy and so on, gay rights, those were the, quote, moral issues. And I would like to propose that if those issues are important to God, what about other issues, such as welfare reform or the environment? Aren't those also important to God? Aren't they also moral issues? As I suggested earlier, I think they are. I think most issues the legislature, most issues our government deals with are moral issues. And to make it clear, I don't think all issues are. You can always discuss whether, the city council may have an issue, which streets do you plow first, and they come up with some system after you do the main ones. Maybe they do alphabetically or reverse alphabetically. I would argue that that's not a big deal of a justice-injustice type of issue. And so I'm not trying to say every issue is a moral issue, but I think most issues in some way or another have a matter, and they're a right or wrong type of concern. However, the candidates who I would say call themselves Christian candidates, not Christians who happen to be political candidates, but the Christian candidate, I think their response to this is, hey, these other things, they're not so important in the same way. They're practical issues. Yes, we want to have a clean environment, but it's a matter of balancing a clean environment versus economic costs. It's not a matter of right versus wrong. It's not a moral issue. And God doesn't tell us what to do here. He doesn't give us specific plans, you should, or here's how you should dispose of your solid waste. On Tuesday, I did talk somewhat about what sorts of themes I saw as most important to biblical themes, namely economic justice and poverty, war and peace, and human rights and human dignity in general. And I don't want to argue that all issues are equally important that way, but I do think it's important to say that that all of these issues in some way or another are going to be, including waste management issues, are things that are important, right versus wrong types of concerns. And next week I do hope to talk, have a number of sessions on some of the issues I consider more important moral issues or more controversial ones, for those who are here then. And while God does not give us precise public policy things on here's how you dispose of your solid waste, as those who would argue certain narrow limited issues are moral issues, the others are not, I don't disagree that he doesn't tell us here's how you ought to dispose of your waste. I also don't know that he gives us clear message on here's how you ought to deal with the abortion issue, here's how you ought to deal with prayer in the public schools. I have strong opinions on those issues. I'm sure probably almost everybody in the room does, and presumably there are as many variations on where we feel on those as there are people in the room. So while he may not prescribe clearly how we ought to deal with environmental protection or welfare reform, he doesn't on any issue. It's our job as Christians to study with a compassionate heart situations and try and respond accordingly. Why do Christian candidates see there to be a very narrow list of what are moral issues? I suggest that maybe that comes from a very narrow interpretation of what sin is. The idea that somebody who drinks too much may be a sinner because they neglect their family and their career and everything for drinking, or somebody who gambles too much, or somebody who steals, somebody who rips off tools from their workplace, and then of course all the sex issues, homosexuality, extramarital sexuality, premarital sexuality, sex seems to be major concerns of theirs in terms of moral issues. And those are all personal acts. Those are all things that we do one-on-one, and it neglects what I say is another, it limits sin to strictly personal things. And whereas I don't see that in the Bible. And Amos, I was just looking up to find out who he was talking to in certain things, but he, thus says the Lord, for the transgressions of Damascus, then another section, for the transgressions of Gaza, for the transgressions of Tyre, for the transgressions of Israel, because they sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of shoes, and they trample the head of the poor into the dust of the earth, and turn aside the way of the afflicted. He's talking to societies, to communities, as if that are sinners as a community. The community commits a sin, corporate type of sins. And I'd argue that the Bible talks as much about corporate sins or social sins as it does about individual or personal sins. We all do it. If I look around, I'm sure 90% of the people here are wearing gold or diamonds, and maybe just a wedding band or something else, but we all buy into a diamond is forever and gold is beautiful, and it's a way we express love without looking at the fact that diamonds are produced in a very unjust system that we don't think about when we buy a diamond, what that means to the lives of the diamond miners and the fact that they're in virtual slavery. They can't live with their families. You've all read about what diamond miners' lives are like in South Africa. They're treated as slaves. And we don't even see that. Yet we all benefit from corporate and social injustice, and therefore are guilty as sinners of these things. Our defense, or why don't we see these things, or why don't we care about these things? I'd say we have two excuses that I hear most often as Christians. First of which is, we didn't see it. And we didn't know there was injustice. Yeah, my wife bought this gold ring. We don't see the injustice that's done among gold miners and diamond miners in Africa. The other excuse we give is, well, we can't do anything about it anyway. It's a big social problem. We're just one person. We can't address those things. As far as the first excuse that we didn't see it, well, that's the easiest excuse, and the one that Christ certainly doesn't see as acceptable. In the story of rich man and parable of rich man and Lazarus, Christ talks about how rich man dies, and, well, I didn't see Lazarus at my doorstep. I didn't see him in his need. Forgive me, I didn't know I was doing wrong by neglecting him. And Christ says, you had your chance, kind of thing. And he says, well, at least send Lazarus back to warn my brothers that they may correct their lives. And says, well, you had Moses and the prophets, and if you won't listen to them, you won't listen to somebody who's risen from the dead to tell them that. And so it's clear that he's not accepting that as our ignorance is not an acceptable excuse. As far as the excuse we couldn't do anything about it, maybe that's legitimate in a totalitarian society where you don't have any say in the way things are set up. In a democracy, we have a responsibility as citizens. Maybe we won't succeed in changing things, but we have to try. It's our responsibility as citizens. I have some suggestions on how we might be able to do that in the talk a couple of days from now. But neither the excuse that we were ignorant about the injustice or that we couldn't do anything about it holds a lot of water. We can find out about it, and we can do something about it. So, before I get into the full period of discussion, I wanted to give some examples of how I see a connection between morality and these political issues. And again, as I said, not everyone is equally great in justice. The first one I'll take, since I mentioned earlier, was waste management. Maybe the sin of throwing away a pop bottle. It's not a big deal. Nobody's going to say that's a gross sin or anything. But what I'd like to suggest is that one-on-one, we're a throwaway society. We throw away paper, which is valuable. We throw away glass. We throw away cans. We throw away just about everything. And we're very wasteful that way. And me throwing away some beverage containers or disposable diapers or whatever we all throw away is not a big deal. It's not the end of the world. On the other hand, the 250 million Americans throwing out McDonald's wrappers every day creates real problems, not just for limited resources like aluminum, but also as far as energy consumption to produce new, and also the waste management problems where we just have landfills. I'm kind of interested in how Holden is dealing with it. We clearly have a heightened sensitivity to recycling and resource recovery here, but basically as a society we throw away and we throw away and we throw away. And I'm not going to argue that it's a big sin to throw away things. Nevertheless, there is a political issue. How can we now take responsibility for the waste we generate rather than dumping the problems on our future generations? Another type of issue might be, well, economic justice I've mentioned before. I know Jack Nelson Pallmeyer has written a number of books on this type of thing. There are a number of poor countries in the world where 3, 4, 5% of the population is in the powerful people. They have control of the land, control of all of the economic valuables. They may have 5% of the population may control 90% of the land. And we wonder why people go hungry. We feed into that system. We think of ourselves, or at least when I was in school, we talked about the U.S. as the breadbasket of the world. But here we are importing most of the fruits and vegetables we eat, at least in winter, in Washington State and in Minnesota and so on. Most of the fruits and vegetables we get are imported. And this is making those people who are in control of the land in other countries sell the food where they get the best price, namely to us, rather than producing crops for local consumption. They prefer export crops, they bring in more money, and we have hungry people as a result. We feed into that system, we benefit from it. We are ignorant about it, and we don't do anything to change it. Foreign relations, we could talk about the kind of issue like arms sales to other countries. We can argue, well, should we give AWACS to Saudi Arabia? Well, a country that's friendly to us, we can strengthen our friendship by selling weapons to them. And there may be some truth to that. You question what's happening, though, when we're selling both to Iran and Iraq. I mean, how many people killed there in the last 7, 8 years? 500,000 people. we don't think of how what those are. Those are brothers and fathers and sons and little kids killing each other with the weapons, the highly sophisticated weapons we give them. We're not the only country that does it. Something like 25 countries have supplied weapons to both Iran and Iraq. It's not like we're doing it because we believe one side's better than the other. It's greed, simple greed. And I'd argue two bad consequences of that. One of which is we're giving countries these sophisticated weapons to kill each other with, and number two, they can't afford it. Pakistan having near nuclear capabilities, all these impoverished countries where people are starving, they're spending a gross proportion of their budget on sophisticated weapons. 20th century technology in countries that have agriculture and economic systems that are feudal in nature. We are ignorant to the problem there. We don't care about it because we don't see it, and we don't want to see it because we benefit by it. Worker safety, I'd argue, is a morality issue. It first drew attention when that garment factory in New York City half a century ago burned and 50 people were locked inside it and burned up with it. Became something we as a society were finally aware of, namely that workers often don't have a choice. If there's a small town in a big factory, that may be the only place you can work, and if it's unsafe, well, that's tough. That's part of the, you don't want the job, take a hike. And unless government steps in and says, listen, there are going to be some basic minimal standards here that we're going to make sure you protect your workers' rights. Chrysler a few months ago didn't plead guilty to it, but they admitted, they accepted in an agreement out of court to pay several $1 million for worker safety violations. Federal government hasn't done anything yet. Well, it's decided that migrant workers ought to have sanitary facilities. And 10 years ago, Congress said that we have to do that, and the administration, 10 years, still has not proposed the rules saying you have to have an outhouse here or whatever you have to have. And the urinary diseases and the diseases that you get from not washing your hands and so on, because there's nothing there, it's cruel. Yet the migrant workers, you can't, they're going to take the job. It's that or starve. You take the job and you've got to live with it. So worker safety, I'd see, is a moral issue, something we have to address as a society. Consumer protection. We bought a refrigerator a couple months ago, and now they all have energy consumption standards on them. For this size refrigerator, the average cost is here. Here's the high and the low cost for this size of model. Here's where this one falls in. It gives a little bit of information to the consumer, and without some requirement, the manufacturer's not going to do that. You're going to buy whatever the cheapest or best advertised or whatever refrigerator is, and that becomes a real crisis in things like automobiles. When Ralph Nader first started talking about how unsafe the Corvair was, we didn't have any choice. You buy a car, and unless you work on cars, unless you study traffic safety as a profession, or you do intensive reading on it, which people don't have time to do, you're not going to know which cars are safer than others, more reliable. I argue that consumer protection is one too. These are just a handful, pretty close to half hour. I'd rather leave it at that and open it up for an overall discussion. And I guess as part of that, I'd like to see if people here agree with this kind of thinking, that all of these things are moral issues. That's one thing I'd like to hear from you on. And another one would be, do you agree that there's this blindness that we all have towards injustice? Is it something we don't want to see, that that worker safety is a moral issue? We don't want to know that we're selling weapons to both sides of a foreign country. I'd like to see if I want to hear from what you have to say about that, and as well, I'd be happy to try and clarify it, but for the next half hour, I'd like to try that.
Well, I agree with everything you've said to a certain point. I guess I see two issues at hand. One is a matter of priority. We can't have our hands in too many pots at one time, so we must select the most heinous of those and work with those. Second of all, a question that all of us has to answer is who's going to pay the bill to do those. Now, I have no objection, but a lot of people do, about paying taxes. And you can't have it both ways. So whatever program is decided upon, we need to determine how we're going to pay for it.
I certainly agree with you too on the, as far as are all these things equally important, and we all have limited time. Most people's maximum political involvement is to read the newspaper once a day, and most people don't even do that much. We all are busy earning a living, studying, preparing to earn a living, taking care of ourselves in one way or another, and plus we do lots of other valuable things, volunteering for things we care about, to have time to do this. And I agree, you personally have so much time, and what I'm not arguing for is that you ought to be involved in all these things. I'm saying that I think they're all moral issues that we all ought to care about, and to the extent possible, pick out which ones you see are most critical and so on. And as far as the paying for it, I don't want to talk for a half hour about this, but with some of these things, first of all, response to a lot of these aren't a question of government spending more money to do it. Worker safety doesn't really cost government much money. It costs business money. But it's a question, is that one of the costs of doing business to make sure you treat, is a humane business person going to treat their workers in this way? Should they do it anyway, even if government didn't force them to? And if so, isn't the forcing them to do so only forcing those who are irresponsible and inhumane to their workers? But there are also many of them that are a question of there's a price to pay for doing these things. And depending on how serious the injustice is and how great the cost of correcting it is, I don't want to answer that question right now. I'm just trying to explain some of the things that might be helpful to us in that.
I think a lot of them are a matter of government spending. I think we've seen during the present administration the deliberate dismantling of regulatory agencies and appointing heads of agencies as a matter of policy those who are least sympathetic with the regulations that those agencies were set up by Congress to enforce.
My response to him is that in terms of the cost of providing worker safety, that means you have to have some OSHA inspectors, and I'm not saying that it's cheap. What I'm saying is that the cost of having an inspector visit 40 factories in a year is far less than the cost of each of those 40 factories coming up to code. So that's the point on that. And as far as that, I won't disagree with you on that. I think the example of the migrant health issue, that's one that the administration has intentionally been dragging feet on. It doesn't take 10 years to decide how many outhouses you ought to have in a farm field. And one other point that I can't recall whether it was Paul Hansen or Larry Rasmussen brought up earlier this week, and that was with the philosophy that the world is going to come to an end 20 years or 15 years or whenever, we don't have to be concerned about posterity. And therefore, James Watt saying we can sell off all of our national resources, our oil reserves, we can sell off our parks, and so on, because we don't need them. The world's going to come to an end anyhow. That's really frightening, but that's...
Well, strange that they don't say that for that reason we don't need to worry about national defense and military defense.
It seems to me that government is something that we have set up as a people to do something for us. But government is only one of many, many agencies which we have set up, and each of these agencies we have in mind doing something for us, maybe good, maybe bad. I'm not at all clear when we go through this long litany that you went through relative to problems, and I'm sure those were only scraping the surface as you indicated, that these are all problems for government to solve. And I wonder how does government receive its mandate from us as a people? And what can we reasonably expect government to do for us as a people efficiently? And how much are we responsible for directly as opposed to indirectly through hiring somebody else, if you will, as a humongous police force to do everything that we see that's not right? Do we have some guidelines here that we can fall back to see how it all got started, and were these expectations always with us, or have they grown in number, in complexity, as society has changed, and so on?
Many points to that question. I'm not sure I'll remember all of them, but one of the things, as far as I think it is growing in, your last thing first, I think it is growing in number, the things, and perhaps two reasons for that. One is society's changing. We didn't need a civil aeronautics board. We didn't need a Federal Aviation Administration 200 years ago. We do need it now, and I don't think anybody's going to dispute we need that now. So society has changed. The world's more complex. We have big business, big labor, big everything. Big banks, big education, big everything. We need big government to respond to that. Number two is we just didn't do some things we ought to have done in the past. We should have been concerned about environmental protection 100 years ago. We didn't know that, and we weren't generating waste or other problems at the same rate we are now. We neglected a lot of things like worker safety for far too long. So I'd argue that both society's changing and that we didn't do some things we should have done in the past. But is in terms of who decides, who does these things, where does government get its mandate? Well, that's a question we each ask. I mean, I'm elected by constituents who, if they don't like what I'm doing, will presumably turn me out of office, and it's not a perfect system because people vote for people who they strongly disagree with across the board because of lack of information or lack of other things, and our democracy isn't a perfect system, but basically that's the way it's supposed to work, namely the mandate of the people to through their elected representatives to do that. As part of that, I may have some disagreements with my constituents that they are willing to live with, they're willing to understand. Namely, I may think that we ought to spend more effort now on paying for our solid waste problems that we're causing rather than keep dumping it in landfills and 20 years from now let our kids worry about it when the cost will be far higher. I may argue that, and somebody else is going to say, that's going to cost money, and that is going to cost money that we're not paying now. Can we afford that? And I think first glance, should we spend more on waste management? I bet 90% of my constituents would say no. If you go through the full issue and discuss what it means and the overall long-term costs, I think I could persuade most of them to change their mind on it. But as far as who sets the mandate, it's, you know, pure democracy, it's the people through their Republican democracy.
We're a nation of laws, and we have constitutions both at the federal and the state level, and other charters, I suppose, at even lower levels than the state level for city government and county government and so forth. Are these inadequate as far as defining what is to be done? In other words, do we have an opportunity as a people to decide what the parameters are for government? Now, I can understand the CAB and the FAA, I can understand the national defense, I can understand the protection of life and property, and there's a great many things that have been ascribed to government over the years. It seems to me that government's arm is reaching out into areas that might better be handled by someone other than government, quite possibly. And are we making a conscious decision as to who should do these things, each of them as they come along, or are we simply letting this pervasive group calling themselves government, whether you're talking about elected or hired people, move into and fill the voids that perhaps should be filled elsewhere?
I don't know that anybody's making a conscious decision government should be doing this or shouldn't be.
That's what
President Reagan clearly talks all the time about how government is too big and too, he talks about government being an evil, and I mean, he can only go on so long like that. He's been, in effect, the main shaper of our national government for the last 8 years, 6 years. And I don't think anybody has made a conscious decision. And I would argue in some ways government shouldn't be involved in some things it is, and other areas that it's not involved in, it ought to be involved in. And one of the things that I'd be more concerned about than it being involved in areas that it shouldn't or should be involved in, I think it's roughly, my concern wouldn't be so much that it's in a whole lot of areas it ought not be in, but rather how it's dealing with these things. OSHA had some very legitimate criticisms of it because they were having somebody where they had their fire extinguishers 58 inches off the floor or something, and they had to be 36 inches for accessibility for people in wheelchairs and others who may need to reach those fire extinguishers. But they'd come in if it was, well, 3 inches above the limit, and they'd make them move them, which was very costly. To hire, if you're a small business owner and but don't have the tools and so on to move these fire extinguishers, have a contractor come in and do that. And so there was some real insensitivity there. On the other hand, what the response in the last few years has been is, let's just stop investigating workplace safety. And so my concern is not so much that government is in hordes of areas that it shouldn't be involved in. I think it ought to be in most of the areas it's involved in. The question is how it deals with them. Does it do it in a sensitive way? Does it do it in a proper way? Maybe somebody else wants to comment.
I think part of what you're suggesting leads me to think that society, not just government, tends to deal with symptoms and not with problems, like in waste management. We spend our energy dealing with what we say is a problem, the waste itself, when in reality, that's the symptom. We consume more than we should. And I think that applies to a lot of things. You know, nuclear energy. Our concern is one of the symptoms of nuclear energy. What are we going to do with the waste? We haven't even begun to look at that issue yet. And each state individually is going to have to look at that as well as the nation as a whole. Everybody wants the power, but nobody wants to provide the land for the dumpage or anything like that. So.
Any comments on it? Because again, a lot of these things, I don't dispute the fact that I'm carrying in Minnesota what Oregon and a number of 10 other states have, container deposit law, and business and industry are united on, labor and business are united on one issue, and that is they hate that. And
they
hate it fiercely, and the public strongly supports it. And I think it's not a perfect solution, but it's a real good idea on how we can deal with about 6 to 8% of our waste stream, recyclable glass and aluminum and plastic. We ought to take them out, and though it's awkward to put a deposit on it, there's no other real way we have as a society of doing it. So I'm carrying that bill and getting shot down on that. And the one of the arguments they use is, hey, this costs a lot of money. Everybody's going to be paying 10 cents more on this, and sure, you get it back, but the cost of administering it, they figure, is about 2 cents per container. It means you're going to pay 2 cents more for every bottle of beer you buy, every bottle of pop you buy. It's going to cost 2 cents more, and that's an additional cost. The public isn't going to stand for that. Well, the polls say they will, and the states that have it, they like it. But my argument to that is, regardless of whether it's popular or not, we're paying that in the long run anyhow. Our landfill costs in Minnesota have gone up about ninefold in the last 4 years. A dump 4 years ago in existence or could have been licensed for about a cost of $5 a cubic yard.
But you see, the problem is that people throw all of this waste away. Mm-hmm. And until you put some penalty on the people, that is, they can't get their nickel back on the container unless they take the container in. If people really wanted to reduce waste, you wouldn't have to go through that process.
Exactly.
People don't want to reduce waste, not if it's inconvenient.
Exactly.
And our highways in Washington attest to that, and we're paying people to walk up and down and collect in plastic containers the refuse along our highways to keep them looking nice.
And they don't, and we voted against having a bottle law in this state twice.
Sure.
We don't want to recycle our bottles and cans.
That's right, yeah. And when you try to institute a recycling program, people don't recycle anything, or the majority don't.
But see, that's
because they're ignorant.
That's one of the areas, and this is a whole discussion on what's the appropriate role of government, and it's, as your whole question is, it's what's right and what's not right with that. There are certain areas of society where each one of us, and it's in our own best interest to throw out the bottle and the can. It's in my best interest. It's more convenient. It's faster. It's everything is in favor of me doing it. But it's very strongly against my self-interest to have all of you throw out your bottles and cans.
Yeah.
And that's true of every one of us. So if we act in our own self-interest as a society, we're going to address the problem. And if we address it as individuals, we're not going to. And therefore, by having government do it, or government provide the incentives, which is what a deposit law in effect does, it's going to cost me if I want to do what I want.
Would your deposit law extend to plastic containers?
Yes, in Minnesota it would.
I see. I don't know that it does that in many.
It doesn't in many, which is a...
I used to recycle the glass containers that we bought the pop in, mm-hmm. the big ones, quart size. But they're not on the shelf anymore.
Yeah.
They're all plastic today.
But that's true also. That's more not because of the deposit laws, though you could argue that pushed them that way. But Minnesota has almost all plastic big ones too. And but that's the nature of how you draft the law. It's a question there. I don't know what you're saying, whether you think a deposit law in that sense is an appropriate incentive for government to provide, or if you're arguing against that, or you're not sure.
I guess what I'm saying is that we as a people don't seem to want to do a lot of things unless we set up some other arm out here who will force us to do it, whether it's liquor on the highway or speeding. Or, I mean, we just love to violate every ordinance and so forth, that anything we can get away with.
I'm terribly curious about what all this has to do with the church.
Hey.
Specific issue. Mm-hmm. Stay with a plastic container.
Okay.
Is that an issue for adult Bible class? Should the pastor be preaching about that? Should your council be investigating it? Or are we just going to sit around and complain about people in the country who don't want to do things?
Yeah, the talk I was going to give yesterday and hope to give sometime was going to talk about somewhat, not only as individual Christians getting involved in something, but when is it appropriate for the church or a church institution to get involved in it. And I'm not sure I'd want to advocate having preachers get up in church every Sunday and say, hey, we ought to have a deposit law. Or, no, we ought not have a deposit law. We could have great political discussion.
I don't think that's the point. Mm-hmm. We as people, as Christian people, have a responsibility. If anything I read in the Bible, relative to our environment, among many, many other things, but a lot of those issues are very definitely church-oriented. Well, I don't hear anything about them. on the Sabbath relative to it's wrong to do this, wrong to do that, and we as a church people need to do something as a Christian group.
I'm not arguing with you to this
benevolent government that we get at great expense out here to do these little things for us that we should be doing for ourselves.
I'm not arguing against you on it. What I'm suggesting, though, in response to Elmer's question, is how do you do that? If we say, hey, this waste management thing is something we got to address. You people got to recycle. You got to do this. We're destroying the world for our kids. It's not, Christ gave us this wonderful world. We have wonderful Holden Village. We see the beautiful mountains, and we dump copper tailings on and just let them sift into the streams. And I agree with you. We got to do something about it. It's our responsibility as Christians. But then you take the next step. What do you say from the pulpit saying, hey, care about your environment, care about your bodies, don't smoke, care about your neighbor, care about this? And yeah, sure, I will. And what's that mean? Does that mean we ought to have deposit laws and so on? I gather that's your question, and that's one that you got to be awfully cautious about, because I can picture a lot of preachers who are going to preach in favor of deposit law being the best thing in the world, and then some other ones saying the exact opposite of that, and you'll have a lot of people spending a lot of time discussing specific political issues in church that never discuss the rest of...
Don't bring up the deposit law. That's got nothing to do. That's a means to an end there. What we haven't discovered yet is that we're doing something that is a sin against mankind. We're abusing what God has given us, and it's a sin against mankind.
Why is it that we can't
talk about those kinds of things?
We can talk about it to that extent,
and we ought to. Can we then get people interested enough to take as much care of the environment as they do their new BMW, let's say, which they spend probably Saturday afternoon or whatever shining so it looks nice on Sunday morning?
It's a very, very good point. I agree.
If education seems to me to be a large portion of what it is we attempt to or need to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's human nature not to do anything until a crisis arrives.
Right.
Now, that's not good, but that's the way it is, as I see it. When they're faced with a crisis, and you can talk about big things, much bigger than what we're talking about right here in the world, but it seems to me that nothing is done until we have a crisis. And that could happen when it comes to saving the human race, too.
Right. We have some crises now that may be pending that are irreversible.
Right. And unfortunately, it seems to me that's...
And I don't think there's disagreement on this issue that the church ought to be doing more. And we ought to be hearing about... your point is, yeah, you don't have to get specific on the issues to say that you as a human have a responsibility to take care of your body, your environment, your everything else. I mean, that's the whole thing about drugs and cigarette smoking and everything else. I mean, talk responsibility about your body, responsibility towards your neighbor, responsibility towards all these things. And the church does do some preaching on this. I don't think. It obviously depends on the individual Christian, the individual pastor, the individual congregation, how much they talk about these things, but I do hear this sort of thing. Maybe not as much as we need to, but I hear some of it, and I don't know what others' experience is in that.
What percentage of the population of our country hear it?
Goes to church and hears it in church or hears it anywhere?
Yeah.
The small amount hears it and the smaller amount responds to it.
It seems to all this, that as Christian stewards, we have a case of hindsight is better than foresight. Mm-hmm. And I think sloth goes along with it too.
Mm-hmm. I think that there is more to what the church does than what the pastor says in 20 minutes on Sunday morning.
I hope so.
Yes, and in that vein, some of these problems, hunger and poverty and churches I've attended, they all have support for food shelves and so on. As we talked about the other day, is support for food shelves going to address hunger problems? Or is that a stopgap measure that we need to fill in the gaps? But it certainly is a good sign of Christian concern. Somebody who is preparing hot meals at a soup kitchen once a month through their church or on their own is going to be a little more sensitive to the needs of those who are unemployed and those who unemployable, perhaps, than somebody who doesn't even see this. I mean, that's one of the ways around that ignorance about these injustices that we don't see. By doing it as a member of a congregation or as an individual, we learn more. And I don't see much disagreement on what we're talking about here.
I'd like to talk to an issue that I think is contemporary and controversial and a little bit on a different date, and that has to do with child care, both child care, taking care of children for mothers who are working, and this is controversial, and it can be provided by a church, it could be provided by the institution that employment is, it could be provided by the government. A few years ago in our congregation, we instituted a program which we thought was going to be a nice thing for our community, providing for the care of some of these kids, you know, latch door kids while their mothers were working. And, you know, we felt well, good about that, but when the kids started knocking holes in the wall and operating in a way that we didn't really like seeing going on in our congregation, we were glad to rid ourselves of it. And I think that as a congregation, we're just happy that the government would take that over so that we didn't have to continue doing something that caused deterioration in our own church institution. Now, I think that that's a very selfish attitude, but I think that's a very human attitude that many of us have toward, is it the responsibility of a church or some other institution, or is it the responsibility of the government? It's tidier to have the government take these responsibilities so that we don't have to have the messy responsibility. And that goes with soup kitchens and many other things that we could be doing, but as many churches, we don't do, I think.
Other comments on that issue?
I think sometimes when we relegate things to the government, it causes more of a separation between the government and us, which there's a real big gap right now. It's like the government is some entity other than we ourselves. Well, ideally, we're the government, not the people that sit in Washington or Minneapolis or any place else, or Sacramento. You know, it's I don't know. Whenever I think of state-run kinds of child care centers, too, I start thinking of the totalitarian states. They do the same thing. That's the way they handle the problem. We have a preschool that I think has worked real well. I don't know what city you put them in.
What age children were you taking care of? Was that older children you were taking care of?
They were grade school children.
Which
they were picked up after school and were there from after school until 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock, whenever it was. Parents came after them.
The other thing is there's not necessarily an either or. It's either got to be a church running a latchkey program or government. I mean, there are kind of mixed things too. I mean, government doesn't have to run as far as daycare. It very seldom. In Minnesota, for example, we have daycare. One of the problems with it is that the people who need it most are the ones who can't afford it, and the people working there are paid minimum wage to take care of human beings. It's a real crisis economically. It just doesn't work in our society. And so we have to do something. We have a sliding scale daycare program which begins to address that. And those things may help the private businesses that want to do it, as well as some of the nonprofit agencies that want to run their own daycares or latchkey programs. So it's not, it doesn't have to be an either or. It can be a cooperative thing, and I'd argue in many of these issues we're talking about, we're not talking about government running something, a deposit law. It's not running something, it's putting an incentive on something. In worker safety, it's not running worker safety, it's setting standards, and the business is addressing it in its own way. So I don't know there has to be a conflict right there either.
I think what we're talking about here is the fact that if we've got the right people representing us in government at whatever level, they will be people who will use wisdom and look properly at all of these issues and come to wise decisions. And I think that is very little in most of these issues with whether or not they are Christian, whether or not the church is influencing them, what Christ thinks about it. Is it right or wrong, just or not just, moral or not moral? And so our responsibility, I think, as Christians, is to do our best to see that the right people are representing us in government.
Yeah. I don't mean to imply by saying that these are moral issues that means we ought to elect Christians to office, because the one example I gave of a, quote, Christian candidate was a bad example in my mind, something that I'd not like to see a lot of in office. But yes, exactly what you came to at the end of your statement, namely that our responsibility is to determine who, since we can't deal with every issue, sort of determine what kind of thing we think is a responsible attitude towards addressing these issues, and from there elect people who are responsible in addressing them.
I'd like to add to that. I think it's important to elect the right people, but if we elect the right people and then we don't have to continue to communicate with them, then the system fails. We have to continue communicating with them so that we keep them on track too.
Now, in Michigan, we do have programs that are federally funded, and church groups carry them out. We have meals on wheels, and different church groups across the board, Methodists, Lutherans, and so on, conduct the program. And volunteers take these meals from the medical care facility and deliver them to these people who cannot get out. And we have church groups who take care of the children, preschool children. And so there can be cooperation.
Yeah. There is, yeah, in Minnesota we have the same sorts of things with Meals on Wheels. And
isn't it a strange thing, though, that we would have the federal government involved in a program of Meals on Wheels for elderly people from a funding standpoint, instead of funding that at a local level? What it says to me is that all of our agencies at the local level up through the state level failed, and the federal government stepped in there. Taxed us more dollars at the federal level and then flowed those dollars back.
There's some truth to the fact that you could argue state and local governments didn't address it, therefore the federal government did. But on the other hand, I don't know that the end result is necessarily bad either, because some states have a very high proportion of elderly population, very high proportion of unemployed and poor people. And if you say, therefore, they've got greater needs there, they tax themselves and run the programs there, that those states that have the greatest needs tend to have the least resources to address them. And if you do it at a federal level, in many ways what I'd argue is best is to have it federally funded and locally administered, because then you have the bureaucratic tendency towards rigidity is less so in a smaller level, and therefore administering it locally may be smarter than funding it locally. But I agree with you, the reason it came at the federal level is local governments may not have done that.
Could you speak to the problem that so many of the local communities are having today, and not only communities but others as well, where insurance rates are so high because of awards coming out of the courts relative to many of these programs that we're talking about, for example, the daycare. I don't know what you did about insurance when you had those youngsters after school But I dare say that most local organizations would not be able to support the insurance programs that would be required to handle children.
That's a real concern, and I'd like to address it, but not in 1 minute, which is how long we have.
I'm sorry.
And I'd be happy to talk with you and anyone else who wants to discuss that one yet. But otherwise, I think we should call this for an end, and I'll be happy to stay around and talk about some other things if people want. Thank you.